Welcome to SCOTUSCast. On April 23, 2008, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Mecham v. Knowles Atomic Power Laboratory. The court was asked to consider whether, under the Federal Age Discrimination and Employment Act, the employer or the employee bears a burden of persuasion as to whether an adverse employment decision challenged as age discrimination was based upon a reasonable factor other than age. Alan Smith, an associate at Grehan, Tavis, Paddock, and Stoner, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Smith.
Hello, my name is Alan Smith. I'm an attorney with the law firm Grehan, Taves, Paddock, and Stoner, and I'm going to discuss Mecham v. Knowles Atomic Power Laboratory with you. To begin, perhaps the most interesting thing about Mecham is that it is only one of a number of employment labor cases this term. Five of these cases, including Mecham, concern the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Whether this is a sign of the Supreme Court's renewed interest in employment and labor law, or simply an anomaly, remains to be seen. Regardless, it is an exciting time for labor and employment law practitioners. The issue in Mecham is whether an employee alleging disparate impact under the ADEA bears the burden of persuasion on the reasonable factors other than age defense. The ADEA prohibits an employer from limiting, segregating, or classifying their employees in a way that adversely affects the employee's status because of the employee's age. It is not unlawful, however, if the employer's otherwise prohibited differentiation is based on reasonable factors other than age. This is known as the RFOA provision. This is not Mecham's first trip to the Supreme Court, although this one has been a bit more extensive. In 2005, the Supreme Court vacated the Second Circuit's original decision, affirming the district court's judgment in favor of Mecham and the other plaintiffs. The court remanded the case for reconsideration in light of its decision in Smith v. City of Jackson, which was decided while Mecham's cert petition was pending. The facts in this case are pretty straightforward. The Knowles Lab is funded by the United States Navy, which sets annual staffing levels for the lab. Based on those levels and new work requirements, Knowles was forced to undertake a reduction in force, or RIF. After being laid off as part of the RIF, Mecham sued, alleging age discrimination. Specifically, he claimed that the RIF had a disparate impact on older employees because 30 of the 31 employees that were let go were over 40 years old. As part of the RIF, employees were ranked on a scale of 0 to 10 on their job performance, flexibility, and the criticality of their skills. Managers then identified the bottom-ranked employees to be RIFed and performed an adverse impact analysis on the identified employees. A board, followed by Knowles general manager and general counsel, then reviewed the manager's selections and the impact analysis. I'll now turn to the Second Circuit's decision. In deciding Mecham, the Second Circuit applied the burden-shifting framework set out in Ward's Cove Packing v. Antonio for analyzing disparate impact cases under Title VII. The court applied this framework in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Smith v. City of Jackson. In Smith v. City of Jackson, the Supreme Court held that disparate impact is cognizable under the ADEA. The plurality based this decision on the ADEA's text, the court's precedent, including its decisions in Griggs v. Duke Power and Hazenpaper v. Biggins. The legislative history, specifically the well-known Wirtz report of the ADEA, and agency deference. In recognizing disparate impact under Title VII in Griggs, the court interpreted language identical to the ADEA's text, except race, color, religion, sex, or national origin was in place of age. But the Smith court noted that the ADEA has a narrower scope than Title VII for a couple of reasons. First, the RFOA provision itself, which plays an important role in disparate impact cases. Second, Congress's legislative response towards Cove, the Civil Rights Act of 1991, expanded Title VII coverage but did not expand the ADEA's scope. Unfortunately, the court's decision to recognize disparate impact under the ADEA did not help Smith or the other plaintiffs. The city's decision was unquestionably reasonable. While there may have been other reasonable alternatives available, the city's decision was not unreasonable. Based on Smith, the Second Circuit held that the appropriate test in ADEA cases is the reasonable test, not the Ward's Cove business necessity test. The reasonableness test requires that an employer rely on reasonable, specific, non-age factors, i.e., reasonable factors other than age, to accomplish the employer's legitimate goals. The reasonableness test emanates from the ADA itself. As I mentioned earlier, the ADEA permits any otherwise prohibited action where differentiation is based on reasonable factors other than age. The reasonableness test recognizes that age, unlike race or other classifications protected by Title VII, not uncommonly has relevance to an individual's capacity to engage in certain types of employment. The reasonableness test, unlike the business necessity test, does not require examining reasonable alternatives that have less impact on a protected class. The Second Circuit held that employees bear the burden of persuasion on the reasonable factors other than age defense. Applying the Ward's Cove burden-shifting framework, Knowles had the burden of offering a legitimate business justification for its actions. Meacham then bore the burden of demonstrating that the proffered justification was unreasonable. To begin, Knowles had to offer a justification for its unaudited and heavy reliance on subjective assessments of criticality and flexibility. Knowles' personnel manager and its experts testified that these assessments were ubiquitous. They were routinely used components of personnel decision-making systems in general and were appropriate under the circumstances. Knowles therefore met its burden, so the burden shifted to Meacham. The Second Circuit began its analysis of Meacham's burden by explaining that it would not sit as a super personnel department in judgment of the wide range of reasonable personnel systems. While the Knowles process was not perfect, it was also not unreasonable. Knowles established guidelines and standards that were intended to prevent and restrict arbitrary decision-making by individual managers. And importantly, Knowles did actually monitor the RIF process. The process will usually be reasonable, even if decisions are based on subjective standards like flexibility and criticality, if these decisions are made by managers who directly supervise the employees. Because age often correlates strongly with legitimate employment needs, the age distribution of the laid-off employees is not by itself probative of the RIF's reasonableness. The Second Circuit therefore held that Meacham and the other plaintiffs failed to establish that Knowles' justification was unreasonable. The Second Circuit's decision created a circuit split and contravened the EEOC's interpretation and application of the RFOA provision. The Supreme Court heard oral argument in Meacham on April 23, 2008. Kevin Russell of Howe & Russell and SCOTUS Blog fame argued on behalf of Meacham and the other petitioners. Daryl Josepher, Assistant Solicitor General, argued on behalf of the United States in support of Meacham. Seth Waxman, former United States Solicitor General and currently a partner with WilmerHale, argued on behalf of Knowles. Justice Kennedy led off by asking why it was necessary to consider alternatives in light of Smith v. City of Jackson. Russell answered that alternatives affect whether the court ever gets to RFOA. RFOA only applies to otherwise prohibited conduct. The Ward's Cove test, which often examines alternatives, is used to determine whether conduct is otherwise prohibited. Justice Ginsburg quickly followed, expressing concern with the layering of tests, creating a double inquiry where a court decides business necessity and then reasonable RFOA. She worried that this will actually make it harder for plaintiffs. Russell responded, this is a result of the ADEA structure, which sandwiches RFOA between two affirmative defenses, bona fide occupational qualification and the foreign country defense, in the same sentence. Chief Justice Roberts pointed out that the ADEA has a narrower scope than Title VII. Russell agreed. He noted that Congress addressed this difference in two ways. First, they gave employers a capacious defense, the RFOA. Second, they did not extend post-Ward's Cove modifications, i.e. the Civil Rights Act of 1991, which lowered the bar for plaintiffs to the ADEA. But, Russell said, Congress did not define unlawful practice differently. Justice Kennedy then jumped back in, positing that the gravamen of the case was simply whether it is unreasonable for the employee to bear the burden of persuasion. Russell acknowledged that this was not an impossible burden for the employee to carry, but the ADEA's text clearly indicates that the burden should be on the employer. This makes perfect sense because the employer, not the employee, usually possesses the relevant information. The Chief Justice quickly countered that this argument wasn't very compelling given the liberal discovery available to employees. Russell acknowledged that discovery can mitigate this disadvantage, but the Chief Justice's objection is true in every case where informational disadvantages are cited as a reason in determining which party bears the burden. Russell finished up by arguing that the EEOC's inartfully drafted regulation, although hard to read, is broad enough to encompass disparate impact and deserves deference. Assistant Solicitor General Josepher began his argument by noting that Congress was aware, when it enacted the ADEA, that defendants generally bear the burden of persuasion on defenses and exceptions. He seconded Russell's point that the RFOA provision is sandwiched between two affirmative defenses. Justice Kennedy stated that this does not necessarily mean that all three are implemented the same way. Josepher responded that it was a matter of interpretation, which unsurprisingly aroused the attention of Justice Scalia, who offered the well-known legal maxim, if it's with two other chickens, it's probably a chicken. Josepher continued by pointing out that Congress has placed the burden of persuasion regarding justification on the defendant in every relevant statute since Ward's Cove. Justice Ginsburg appeared troubled that adopting the Meacham government position will make the ADEA more generous to plaintiffs than Title VII, because the entire burden will be on the employer. Josepher replied that the ADEA is actually much more employer-friendly, because the reasonableness test, which accounts for more innocent explanations of age disparity, is not very daunting. The Chief Justice finished off by inquiring about deference. Josepher explained that although the EEOC regulation was at best inartfully written, it was still entitled to Chevron deference. Josepher then turned to Justice Kennedy's earlier question on whether it was appropriate for the court to consider, if the RFOA provision is ambiguous, where the burden should rest as a matter of efficiency or policy. Josepher argued that it made more sense to place that burden on the employer, but he conceded that it is reasonable as a policy matter to place the burden on either party, because either way, the sky is not going to fall, in his words, which is always good to hear. Former Solicitor General Waxman began by focusing on the function and structure of the ADEA. He emphasized that the court has applied its burden-shifting framework in a wide range of employment law cases. The Second Circuit's decision in Meacham harmonizes with this precedent and simply makes sense. He claimed that the sandwich effect, the RFOA's provision's placement between two affirmative defenses, was unpersuasive, and he did not say anything, and it did not say anything about the burden shifting regarding the RFOA. Waxman was involved in an extended discussion with Justice Souter and, to a lesser extent, Justice Stevens about the differences between these two affirmative defenses and the RFOA provision. Fortunately, Justice Ginsburg interrupted Waxman's later long dissertation on the factual and procedural background of the case to inquire about the rather startling numbers involved in the case. As you may remember, 30 of the 31 employees who were RIFed were older than 40. Waxman acknowledged that the District Court, Second Circuit, and even Knowles itself found the numbers strikingly stark. Knowles had even considered reworking the process to address this issue, but it was afraid of running afoul of New York State reverse discrimination law. Waxman also conceded, in response to another question by Justice Ginsburg, that regardless of what objective standards and requirements are in place, the process still calls for human judgment. Waxman stated that ultimately, you're relying on one person's judgment of another. This, he said, goes to the heart of the second question presented on appeal, whether granting supervisors broad discretionary authority during the RIF constituted a RFOA. The court did not grant cert on this question. Ultimately, this question may have a greater impact on ADEA cases, but it will have to wait for another day. Forecasting the court's decision in most cases is extremely difficult. In this case, especially so, given the distance in time since Ward's Cove and the recent turnover on the High Court. The following are some factors and indicators of where the court may be headed. Justice Stevens, Scalia, and Kennedy are the only members of the court remaining who were also on the bench when Ward's Cove was decided in 1989. Kennedy and Scalia were in the Ward's Cove majority, while Justice Stevens authored an impassioned dissent. And Smith, Stevens acknowledged that Ward's Cove governed ADEA disparate impact claims. Justices Kennedy and Thomas, who did not recognize disparate impact in the ADEA context, agreed with Justice Stevens that if these claims are cognizable, they are governed by Ward's Cove. They may have tipped their hand further by joining O'Connor in stating that once the employer has produced evidence that its action was based on a reasonable non-age factor, the plaintiffs bear the burden of disproving this assertion. Because Chief Justice Rehnquist did not take part in Smith, one cannot even use his decision as a rough proxy for that of Chief Justice Roberts. Finally, Justice Breyer recused himself from this case, leaving the more liberal wing of the court without one of its usually reliable votes in employment law cases. That does it for this time. I look forward to following up on Meacham with another podcast when the court hands down its decision. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.